At the Iowa legislature, the scheduled date of adjournment has come and gone, along with lawmakers' per diem expenses. But are the extended hours at the State House unusual? It's Politics Day here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, our focus is state politics. We'll look back at memorable moments from past legislative sessions with longtime political reporters, Kathy Obradovich, political columnist for the Des Moines Register, James Lynch, politics and state government reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, and our own Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. We'll also discuss the work of the Iowa Caucus Review Commission and the state's looming congressional races. Politics Day here on River to River continues after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day here Wednesday on River to River. This hour, we're going to focus on politics here in Iowa. The scheduled date of adjournment has come and gone at the Iowa legislature, and this hour we want to spend some time discussing State House activities as we near the end of the session. Spend a little time also looking back, perhaps, at some memorable moments from past legislative sessions with several longtime political reporters joining us from the State House Law Library. Joining us for the hour, Kathy Obradovich, political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Great to have you back on the program, Kathy.
Glad to be here, Ben.
Also alongside Kathy, James Lynch, politics and state government reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. James, welcome back to you.
Hi, Ben.
And I don't know if I can say welcome back. Of course I can. Joyce Russell, you know her from Mondays. I feel like I'm sitting in the wrong seat here, Joyce, discussing this.
Okay.
But Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. As a trio, Kathy, James, and Joyce, I was trying to figure up in my head, I think we have somewhere around a half century of state political expertise at hand this hour. That's impressive.
Thanks for making us feel old.
Okay. Before we do go to the legislature, though, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about Iowa GOP officials today giving an update on their effort to reexamine the Iowa caucuses. Joyce, I wonder if you can remind us, before we get into the happenings of today, the timeline of what happened during our Iowa caucuses this year.
Well, it was a very close result on the night of the caucuses, and Mitt Romney was declared the winner by just a handful of votes, although it was very clear that there were some missing votes already that night, it was clear. And so there was kind of a feeling of a draw that night. Then when some additional votes came in, it turned out that Rick Santorum was the winner. And then there was some sort of diffidence and not very much forthrightness among party officials on who, at one point, one of the party leaders said, well, I'm not sure we're going to have a winner in the Iowa caucuses. Well, that just kind of threw some doubt and not a very good light on the caucuses. And as a result, there's an effort underway, a systematic review of the way information is released to the public, the way the votes are tabulated, and also perhaps most critically, how volunteers are trained, because it is volunteers who do all of the work on caucus night.
Now, I understand Republican Party of Iowa co-chairman Bill Schickel talked to reporters about what's happening in this review committee. What can you tell us there today?
Well, I just outlined the three areas that they're working on, and there's subcommittees at work. They're drawing on some national expertise as well. Bill Schickel, Republican Party of Iowa official Bill Schickel, held this news conference this morning. He was asked how big of a problem do they have to solve, and this is what he said.
The bad news is that the caucuses have been characterized by others as a fiasco, as a clown show. Some out-of-town media have characterized it that way. The good news is that on caucus night, we had 100% of precincts reporting. Our certification process, 99% of the caucus precincts were certified. And all of this was done despite the fact that we had one of the largest turnouts in the history of the caucuses, and we had one of the closest elections in the history of presidential politics. And so I think we did 95% of everything right, but we did make some mistakes as well. And we have to look at those mistakes, acknowledge them, review them, and fix them. And that's what we intend to do as a committee.
Republican Party of Iowa co-chairman Bill Schickel there from this morning. Let me turn to you, Kathy Obradovich, and then to you, James, too. Let's talk about whether this will have long-term implications. Other states, of course, envying Iowa's role hosting First in the Nation contest in this presidential nominating contest. Has this episode put that in jeopardy now that we have this latest statement of the review committee, Kathy?
The Iowa caucuses are always in jeopardy. Every 4 years, Iowa has to defend not only its role in the start of the presidential process, but also really to defend the caucus process itself. This cycle, I think the spotlight is even more so on the caucus process, because other states besides Iowa had problems. Las Vegas or Nevada, Missouri, Maine, all had problems with their caucuses. And so now people are saying, well, why should we allow caucuses in the first place? Now, that's important to Iowa, because if Iowa does not have a caucus, Iowa will not be first in the nation. Iowa does not have the option to look at a primary as Maine is doing, for example. So you really do have to – Iowa really has a double role now of defending its own first in the nation role and caucuses. And here's a little – tip to Bill Schickel: if he's worried about public information,
I know
do not
what you're
use
say.
The words clown show and fiasco ever again as it relates to the Iowa caucuses.
I had the exact same thought. Wow, what are the words that jump out in that minute clip? Of course, fiasco and clown show were them, and undoubtedly used perhaps by members, representatives from other envious states. Who knows? Your thoughts on this, James Lynch?
Well, I think Kathy's right that the caucuses are always in jeopardy, or at least the first in the nation status. Listening to Bill Schickel this morning, it almost reminded me of Republicans are starting a 12-step program to fix the caucuses. They have to acknowledge their mistakes and I guess be sorry for their mistakes, and I suppose they probably grieve somewhat too. But I think they're serious, because I think they know the danger here. As Kathy mentioned, just caucuses in general, people are asking why caucuses instead of primaries. Mm-hmm. And in talking to Bill at a forum earlier this year, he was talking about the long knives coming out that other state parties will use this as another way to attack Iowa's first in the nation status.
Okay, let's move on. If we had a lot of material we would like to cover this hour, I'd like to get your thoughts on these. James Lynch, Joyce Russell, and Kathy Obradovich. Let's turn to the legislature right now, talk about what is currently going on at the State House as this session appears to be nearing adjournment. Education reform, perhaps we can start there. Top priority for Republican Governor Terry Branstad. Republicans, Democrats alike in the legislature have echo the need for improving K through 12 schools. However, finding that agreement has been a daunting task. The differences, I understand, appear to be narrowing between the Iowa House and the Senate on education reform. Can you tell us, James, what is the deal that appears to be coming into focus?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. The House has moved yesterday, approved amendments to the education reform bill that bring it closer to the Senate, but I'm not sure that there is consensus yet on what that's going to look like. I think it's pretty clear the governor isn't going to get all that he's asked for, and he's been quite adamant throughout the session that, you know, he doesn't like this watered-down version that the Senate approved, and now it appears the House has watered down its bill somewhat too. So I'm guessing that what we're going to see is some sort of a deal and a promise to come back and reform education again next year. Mm.
There are a couple of things in the Republican-controlled House that Republicans agreed to throw overboard in order to come closer to the Democrats. They've thrown out what the governor wanted on charter schools, for example, what the governor wanted on taking seniority into account. Not taking seniority into account when you lay off teachers. So they have thrown a few things overboard to come to the middle, but getting the Senate to agree to much of what's still in there, that's going to be a tough sell.
One of the things I do agree on is that you need to focus a lot more resources on making sure kids can read by third grade. Now, the original proposal had a drop-off point where the kids weren't going to necessarily get promoted if they didn't read up to grade level by third grade. And I think that some of those things are also probably going to fall out. Also, maybe some of the hard exit exams for high school seniors. Mm-hmm. I would guess that some of those things are going to fall off before the end as well.
I understand the first bill proposed by the Branstad administration in the session's earliest days ran to 125 pages. The latest House proposal, only 40 pages. I wonder, what does this mean, Kathy, for Branstad as a governor putting this forward as a signature piece?
Well, I think that, you know, Governor Branstad is taking a risk here, and I think he realized he was going to be taking a risk. When he ended his last term as governor, he ended with basically a failed effort at education reform. This is something where he clearly felt like he had unfinished business, wanted to make a significant start in the first year, but he had already acknowledged before the session that he wasn't going to get done everything that he wanted to get done in 1 year. He wanted to get as much done as possible before we have another election cycle and a whole new legislature that has to be, you know, re-educated about what needs to be done and why it's important. So he is making his best stab at getting as much as possible done this year. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it's over with if he doesn't get everything he wants this year.
Right off the bat, they took teacher pay off the table, and there's a big task force working on that now. So that paying teachers more based on their merit than on seniority, just wildly controversial in the teaching community. And so very early on, the Branstad administration made the decision that that was going to be too much for sure for this year. So there's a sort of a separate effort going on that we'll probably see a bill on next year.
Joyce Russ, James, go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. I think this is one of those areas where the governor knows he's taking a risk, but at the same time, there's a lot of public sentiment on his side in that people look at schools and say, we need to do better. They may not know how to do better or what needs to be done, but I think the public sentiment is on the governor's side. And I guess that's not to say that legislators are on the other side opposing reform and improving schools, but I think the governor can take a little bit this year and continue to build, you know, take his message to the public between, you know, May and next January to build more support for sort of the next step in the reform process.
And I would just add to that there has been a stark difference in the debate. And some of this is Democrats playing to their base, of course. But there also seems to be, and I've said this before, an almost genuine mystifiedness, I should say, on the part of Democrats saying, our schools aren't that bad, you know, and that's come out in the debate.
At the same time, Joyce, I think divided government is an asset to the governor right now because the things that he wants to get done ultimately are going to have to be bipartisan and that they are ultimately going to have to appease both the sort of Democrat-leaning constituencies and the Republican-leaning constituencies for schools. And so having something go through a divided legislature is probably the best shot at getting something that would be a lasting reform.
Kathy Obradovich with us, political columnist for the Des Moines Register. James Lynch of the Gazette in Cedar Rapids and Joyce Russell, our Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Let's move on here to another topic and invite listeners. If you have questions, concerns about state politics, well, we've got a lot of political expertise. I won't say exactly how many years are in that trio we have here on the air this hour. Well, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's spend a few minutes talking about the budget. Negotiators for the Iowa House, the Senate, and governor continuing efforts to narrow their differences on an overall budget number that could pave the way for adjournment later this week. James, can I tell you? Turn to you for the latest. What is it looking like?
Well, things are developing probably as we speak. the negotiators from the House and Senate continue to meet, and Craig Paulson, House Speaker Craig Paulson, told me this morning they're very close to the global budget number, and now they're pushing around some of the big numbers within the budget, and hope to get an agreement today, which is essentially the same message we heard Monday and Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But if they're getting closer each day, I guess that's a good sign. They started out somewhere around $250 million apart between the House Republicans and the Senate Democrats. And our understanding is that the House Republicans and the governor have agreed to a number that is closer to the governor's number than the House Republicans' number, which also puts it closer to the Senate Democratic number. But they're still reviewing and mm-hmm. pushing those pieces around.
Who can tell me what are the major differences, differences in the budget that still stand in the balance?
Well, as James is explaining, until they agree on an overall budget number, there's differences all the way down the line, although I think there is one budget bill that has passed and wasn't controversial. Mm-hmm. But one of the most high-profile ones has been the education budget, particularly funding for higher education, where the governor, after several years of budget cuts, the governor recommended additional spending for the regents, and Senate Democrats recommended even more. And then House Republicans came in at $30 million below last year. So the differences there have been quite stark.
Also,
The House Republicans also had agreed to fully fund the tax credits that are on the books. That was a difference between both the governor and the Senate. And they did not fund a $25 million education fund that the governor wanted and that the Senate had agreed to do. So in a lot of ways, it's been the governor and the Democratic Senate against the House in trying to get some of the agenda items that the governor wanted.
In this divided legislature, does the governor like what he's seeing develop here on the budget?
Oh, I think he probably is, because when he landed in the middle between Senate Democrats and House Republicans, I mean, common sense says, you know, you're going to land somewhere in the middle. So I think he knew from the beginning they would probably move towards his number. And his number was actually not that far from what Senate Democrats were proposing. So that, you know, the governor and the Senate Democrats have sort of been working to bring House Republicans along. And House Republicans said from the beginning that, you know, their budget numbers were just a starting point, mm-hmm. that they knew they were going to have to come up to meet the governor and the Senate.
House Speaker.
I would just add that one of the, you know, what you hear Republicans say, House Republicans say, is they don't want the state to spend more than it takes in. They don't want to spend what they call one-time dollars for ongoing expenses. And one of the key committee chairs told me, he said, you know, the big problem this year is just how big of an ending balance we have. I said, that's a big problem? Well, it is a big problem because Democrats, you know, there have been years of budget cuts. Things are better now. They want to tap those funds, and the Republicans see that as one-time money. Those aren't ongoing revenues. That's a little extra from last year.
Okay. A lot of times legislators find it more difficult to balance the budget when they have to say no to more people.
House Speaker Craig Paulson, I understand, says he thinks there's a shot at ending the session on Saturday. Is that where it stands, the best guess at this point?
No, I think he's revising that. This morning when I talked to him, he didn't completely rule it out, but he seemed to be leaning towards Monday or Tuesday adjournment now. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is that with all these budgets that have to be resolved and a number of other pieces of legislation, you're looking at 48 to 72 hours just to redraft and print bills and you know, proof them. So it's getting to the point where finishing this week, I think, is pretty much out of the question.
But extended hours at the State House, not an unusual thing, is it?
No, it's not unusual. But part of what happens is, as James just said, you have to wait for the paperwork, and so they don't necessarily want to leave lawmakers sitting around here for hours and hours and hours waiting for bill copies to be drafted and copied, et cetera. So, and a lot of times, you know, this week right now we're hearing a lot of retirement speeches on the part of legislators who aren't coming back, and so that's been filling the time. But soon we're going to have some hours where everybody's just sort of sitting around waiting for final deals and waiting mm-hmm. for paper.
I think we may see most of the legislators go home. Conference committees may meet Thursday, Friday, maybe into the weekend if necessary, and then call the whole legislature back either Monday or Tuesday to act on conference committee reports and ramp things up. But it doesn't take all 150 legislators to do that conference committee work.
We have a few minutes before we have to take a break. James, Kathy, and Joyce, you've all covered state politics so for many years. I wonder if we could get a quick anecdote, a favorite anecdote from a past session to share. Who wants to go first? Or who has one come to mind?
Well, if we're talking about anecdotes for shutting down the session, I think I've heard people tell stories about alcohol stories among legislators actually drinking in the waning hours. I never saw that, but I did walk past a lobbyist tailgating party in one of my early sessions here.
Really?
I popped out of the building to get some fresh air, and there was a tailgate going on the grounds.
Complete with a barbecue?
No, just liquid libations.
All right. Any other memories to share out there? That's pretty good, Joyce.
Well, I would just say that, you know, in the waning hours of legislature is when these late night deals can happen. And one of the things that happened was the creation of the Iowa Communications Network in the middle of the night in a bill where nobody had really probably read it before it went through. And we still have that communications network today. And lawmakers talk almost every year about how can we get rid of this thing. Those are just an example of things that can happen. And the other thing is, people get tired, people get grouchy. And a lot of times you start having really contentious debates in the middle of the night.
Mm. Kathy, I understand that you were at a Jimmy Buffett concert last night,
yes.
reading your column there, as was the governor, right? The governor's wife is a big Jimmy Buffett fan.
Well, the governor told me he was planning to be there, and the reason he was planning to be there was because the first lady had seen Jimmy Buffett in concert in the Caribbean and wanted to see him again. So I think that qualifies her as a parrot head.
Tell us, for those who don't know, what is a parrot head?
A parrot head would be like a Jimmy Buffett fan who follows him around to concerts. And, a lot of times they wear crazy costumes like parrots on their heads.
Mm-hmm. And last night at the concert, you and the governor were treated to a good performance?
It was an awesome concert, and over 2 hours, and just terrific. I'd never seen Jimmy Buffett before, but I can see why the First Lady would want to see him again.
Did you see the governor and the First Lady swaying in the crowd anywhere?
I did not see them, so I just have to take it on their word that they were there.
Okay. Kathy Obradovich, please stand by. James Lynch with us of the Gazette as well. Joyce Russell of Iowa Public Radio with us. We're enjoying Politics Wednesday here on River to River, and we'll be back in just a moment to talk, among other things, about a class action lawsuit dismissed yesterday. We'll find out about that when we return. And let's have a little Jimmy Buffett as we go into this break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
She came down from Cincinnati. It took her 3 days on a train. Looking for some peace and quiet. Hope to see the sun again. But now she lives down by the ocean. She's taking care.
So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm joined this hour by longtime political reporters joining us from the State House Law Library, Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, James Lynch of the Gazette, and Joyce Russell, our very own Joyce Russell of Iowa Public Radio, our State House correspondent, talking about focusing this Politics Wednesday on state politics, a few national politics, I think, mixed in here in this second half hour. If you have a question or a concern, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Mixed in with discussing statehouse activities, the budget, education reform, we're spending a little bit of time looking back at memorable moments from past legislative sessions, especially ones having to do with adjournment, because we seem to be on, can never tell, seem to be on the eve of an adjournment. I wonder if there are any other stories in our panel out there that may be worth sharing about past sessions nearing adjournment.
Ben, I recall in 2009, the session lasted until about 5 or 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and it was sort of one of those things where it was a very long day on Friday, and then Saturday never really ended. They were in session throughout the day and the night, and as Kathy mentioned, people get very tired, and I was over in the Senate, and some senators just sort of abandoned all sense of dignity and propriety and laid down on the couches and went to sleep. Like I said, it was not a very dignified scene over there, but, you know, they needed their sleep, I guess. contrasted with the next year when they adjourned a day ahead of schedule in the middle of the day, and were quite proud of the fact that, you know, they got done early and in the light of day. Mm-hmm. So I guess those are sort of bookends of my legislative adjournment stories.
James, your colleague Todd Dorman, the Gazette columnist, produces this one. He's the husband of our producer, Catherine Perkins. He writes the 1989 session went into May. Lights went out on the final night. He says he thinks it was because of an accident. It hit a pole or there was a thunderstorm. He says he can't remember exactly. I sat in the clerk's office by candlelight listening to the Senate audio through a speaker, had some emergency power for some of the things. He writes, writing down what they did so the House clerk knew what bills might be coming. That adjournment at 4:30 in the morning. Joyce, you had another little story.
Well, I think this might have been the same session that James was talking about that finished in the middle of the night, but Senator Jack Kibbe, who's the Senate president, and he's presiding. And, you know, like many of us, he's no spring chicken, and it's hard to keep going in the middle of the night like that. And he had just a kind of a charming open mic problem. His mic was open, and he didn't know it, and he said, "Can we go home now?" But as open mic problems go, I guess that one's not so bad.
Okay. Let's talk about a class action lawsuit. A Polk County judge yesterday dismissed a class action lawsuit filed by African-American state employees against the state of Iowa. The suit alleged the state had systematically passed up African-American employees for government jobs or promotion within their departments because of a culture of subconscious bias. It was the first time this legal argument had been used in court. Thomas Newkirk, lead attorney for the plaintiffs, says the suit is trying to change the way courts understand discrimination. And Newkirk acknowledges the state has policies in place to guard against discrimination in hiring practices, but he says policies are not enough.
They made about as much difference as your doctor telling you to wash your hands to cure your cancer. It doesn't make any difference at all. And in fact, it can be harmful because it makes you think that that's all you need to do to cure the cancer that's eating away at you inside. That's what the state has done, is that they said, do these pretty, follow these frilly words, do these nice little things. That will solve the problem. They've never once taken a fundamentally new approach to how bias works, how it affects decision making, and its extent, and the extent to which it is in the room when people who look like me are making decisions about people who look like my clients.
Newkirk says that they plan to appeal the decision and pursue individual discrimination suits against the state. May I turn to you, Kathy Obradovich, your thoughts on this case? It has a historic approach to this type of case, doesn't it?
This is a new approach, and I don't know, I can't predict how this will play out in the courts. I assume that Polk County District Court is not the last stop for this case, and we may see review higher up. But I have to say that this is not a new situation. The cases have been settled in the past. This is a new class action case. But this has been going on for years where Folks have been alleging different problems with state hiring related to racial bias, and it has had some effect. Past governors have had reviews of their hiring practices and really tried to ferret out problems to make sure that they don't have these kinds of problems in the future. Now, I don't know how Mr. Newkirk is arguing that a state policy is not going to get at subconscious bias, and I can certainly understand how he makes that point, but also I don't see how you can ever resolve subconscious bias mm-hmm. if you can't rely on policies.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a number of other items in politics here. Comment on these. Interesting. A side note to the GOP presidential nomination contest for Iowa. Of course, Mitt Romney, well on his way to becoming the presumptive nominee. I don't think he's earned that title yet. We're not calling him the presumptive nominee. We'll probably be doing that in a few weeks. A week, however, after he quit the presidential race, fundraising mailers from Rick Santorum arrived in Iowa mailboxes this week with a strongly worded warning. Quote, "It truly frightens me to think what'll happen if Mitt Romney is the nominee," says the letter signed by Santorum, paid for by his campaign. The undated letter says there's still time for conservatives to make sure the GOP doesn't nominate, quote, "a Massachusetts moderate," and that Republicans would be crippled if Romney were to be the nominee. Now, according to Santorum campaign spokeswoman Alice Stewart, the mailers were paid for and sent for sent before Rick Santorum stepped out of the race. Thoughts from our group on this letter? we know politics can be a devious, crafty sort of activity. Do we believe that?
Well, I tend to think that what you just described is the actual explanation here, and that is that the mailers were sent out. These things take time to process, because Herman Cain had a similar issue with his campaign, that he had dropped out of the race, and then things were still arriving in people's mailboxes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the campaign is still constituted, and it still needs to make money, raise money to retire its debt. And so there, I got some campaign fundraising in my email box as well, post, post Santorum stepping out of the race. But I took that as being him trying to retire his debt. However, this sort of rhetoric against Mitt Romney suggests to me that Rick Santorum may not be endorsing him anytime soon.
Mm. And I'm just wondering the effect on voters if you can use those words and then, to some degree, embrace Mitt Romney in the coming weeks, to whatever degree, the effect that has on the voter's mind. That we can switch it on and off as a light, our endorsement and our wrathful words.
Well, I think some people will look at it and just say that's just politics. That's the way it is.
Right.
You fight the battle on the field, and when it's over, you put your arms around each other and go home and have a beer or something. But I think for a lot of other people, it makes them more cynical about the process.
Exactly.
How you can say I'd be truly frightened of Mitt Romney and then turn around and support him. I don't know that. I guess for a group of longtime political reporters, we probably see it sort of as that's the way the game is played. But for truly partisan people, if you're a true Santorum supporter, you probably tend to believe that and hold on to that, that you should be frightened, too, of Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the Santorum supporters were automatically going to rush to Mitt Romney anyway, and that makes Mitt Romney's job in Iowa even more difficult. Iowa is going to be a swing state, a battleground. Republicans have really increased their registration in Iowa, 3,000 more than Democrats now, where they were way down after 2010. And so they need, or after 2008, so they need to come together as a party. And if Mitt Romney is the nominee, they're going to have an extra problem doing that because of that kind of rhetoric coming from Romney's rivals in Iowa.
Kathy Obradovich with us, James Lynch, Joyce Russell, winding up an hour as we talk mostly state politics. Yesterday, U.S. Representative Tom Latham of Iowa testified before the U.S. House Armed Services Committee in opposition to a proposed budget cuts facing the 132nd Fighter Wing of the Iowa Air National Guard, based in Des Moines. The Air Force in February proposed eliminating $8.7 billion in spending while retiring hundreds of aircraft worldwide, including all of the F-16 aircraft in Des Moines. The plan would also eliminate 378 people now serving with that 132nd Fighter Wing, including 81 full-time employees. Who can update us on this? Is this a done deal, even though we have, of course, our representatives going to bat for it?
I don't know if it's a done deal, but I have to say that this illustrates the difficulty that comes with trying to cut the budget, and particularly military budget, which is a big portion of the overall discretionary spending. You have a situation where even the military wants to cut what they consider to be wasteful spending, and yet you have the local constituency fighting against it in Congress. And, you know, in Iowa, I think that our congressional delegation is doing a good job of going to bat and saying, let's really make sure that this makes sense and that the Air Force can justify this. And in fact, they say that this fighter wing is more really cost efficient than some of the other alternatives. But, you do have situations where military wants to get rid of weapon systems, et cetera, and the people back home whose factories are making those systems are fighting every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. And this battle is going on in other states as well, where the Pentagon has recommended cuts in National Guard and Air National Guard forces. So there, it's not just Iowa that it has been singled
right.
out.
And it would be truly news making if a representative from a state impacted by a cut would stand up and say, I'm in favor of that cut. That would be the news, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
I would just add to this that I've seen Tom Latham campaign every 2 years now for a long time, and I've seen him go dormant for months and months and months. We don't hear anything from him, and then he really ramps up his PR effort right before an election, and he, of course, has the election of his life coming up.
Right.
So he wanted to make sure I sort of saw it in that light that he made sure that we all knew what he was doing for the fighter jets.
I wonder, Joyce, James, and Kathy, if there are other local issues that figure into congressional races, as this one does, that you can point to where our representatives in Washington are voicing their opinions on them.
Well, in eastern Iowa, both Congressman Dave Loebsack and Congressman Bruce Braley make quite a big deal out of every time they squeeze some money out of FEMA or the Army Corps of Engineers for flood relief in the Cedar Rapids, Cedar Valley, eastern Iowa area. So, I mean, that's one of those local issues where they're, using it to show how effective they are in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Supreme Court retention as we turn our head, look back look toward the November elections. We cast our minds back to the last elections, 2010, when three Iowa Supreme Court justices not retained, that after a campaign to oust them because of their part in a decision to declare Iowa's ban on same-sex marriages unconstitutional. Now, in the coming election, there is one Iowa Supreme Court justice who was involved in that case, the Varnum v. Bryan case, Justice David Wiggins, up for retention this year. However, all three justices appointed by Governor Branstad to fill the vacancies when those three justices were voted out in 2010 will also be on the ballot for retention. I wonder what your thoughts are on the likelihood that we'll see some sort of mobilization against David Wiggins by the Vanderplaats group, which led the campaign last time.
I don't know if Bob Vanderplaats will lead the mobilization, but I expect that there will be one. And one of the reasons why is that if Mitt Romney is the likely nominee, there needs to be something to get those religious conservatives and the Rick Santorum backers excited about the election and get them out. And frankly, I would be worried if I were David Wiggins that he's going to be sort of the rallying point for conservatives if they are not excited about Mitt Romney.
Isn't there, though, a complicating factor in that on this ballot, if we can think about what the ballot would have to look like, the voters will have to distinguish between him and the Branstad appointees who are also up for retention. And that can be confusing to word on a ballot, can it?
It's going to get tricky because, I mean, last time it was easy, just vote against everybody. And this time you have to know which one specifically to vote against. So I think they're going to have to really do a lot more voter education if they want to get rid of Wiggins but not get rid of Terry Branstad's appointees. And that's assuming they don't want to get rid of Terry Branstad's appointees.
Yeah, and, we've heard in debates on the justice system budget here in the legislature this year in among conservative Republicans, they sort of don't like the whole court system in some cases. And so I certainly wouldn't want to be one of those Branstad appointees on the retention ballot.
In 2010, there was a worry that people would not just stop at the Supreme Court justices, that they would just vote against all the judges on the ballot. And that did not really happen. So, I do understand the concern, but remembering one name is not that difficult. If you look at the sort of public information campaign that the opponents of the justices had in 2010.
Okay. Let's spend the four or five minutes we have remaining in talking about the state legislative races to watch come November. Kathy, I know you wrote about this recently. What are you looking at in particular?
Well, there's a couple of races where incumbents are pitted against each other, and I think that those are often the most interesting to watch. One that I highlighted was up in north central Iowa. Merlin Bartz, longtime Republican, is facing a Democrat, Mary Jo Wilhelm. It is a changing landscape. Merlin Bartz has a lot more experience in the legislature than Mary Jo, but she has represented more of this district than he has. I think it will be sort of a classic Republican versus Democrat type of argument in the race. But I think it's also going to be a lot about personality and who can get to know people in the new parts of the district better and faster.
James, the races or the race that interests you?
One that I find fascinating is a primary race between Republicans Pat Grassley and Annette Sweeney. Both are incumbent House members, and they've been thrown into the same district by the redistricting process. And what's really interesting is they've both been there a few terms. They both chair a committee in the House, so they are sort of kind of on equal footing in that way. However, one of them is the grandson of a sitting U.S. senator, and it's sort of shaping up to be a bit of a proxy fight between some interest in the Republican Party, those folks who are sort of loyal to Senator Chuck Grassley and benefit from his fundraising capabilities, and those who are sort of aligned with Bruce Rastetter and his mm-hmm. fundraising capabilities.
And as you pointed out in some writing recently, James, the candidate can face a real dilemma when a primary challenge comes about. Explain. In terms of aligning with a more moderate or a more conservative parts of the party.
Yeah, I mean, you have to play to your base, and you know, in a Republican primary, the base for both of these people are conservatives. Both it's a pretty much rural district. I think there are not any big towns in this district, so the base is pretty much the same, and they have to, they're going after the same votes essentially. I suppose there could be, you know, some regional, as far as capturing your home county, those sorts of things that will play into it. You have a woman against a man. There could be some gender politics there. But essentially, they're fighting for the same votes.
Okay. We're fighting for the last few minutes of this program. We have 2 or 3 minutes left. I wanted to ask you if there is something that we haven't talked about in regards to state politics that we should be talking about or at least mentioning at the close of this hour.
I'll just throw out commercial property tax reform at the State House. That is, I think, the one thing that legislators cannot adjourn without accomplishing. And we're still hearing that there's talks going on, and so far not a lot of resolution. The governor, when I talked to him yesterday, was very optimistic and hopeful. But these are some difficult issues, and there's a reason why they haven't been able to do anything on commercial property taxes for the last 30 years.
Okay. James or Joyce?
Well, I agree that's one of those issues that they need to do something on, but I think the gulf is pretty wide there. It might be one where they take a small step and make a promise to come back, like they did with mental health reform, which still is unsettled. There's just a whole lot of issues that haven't been settled yet.
Hmm. Okay. Any other thing we haven't talked about? A listener, Jeff, on our Facebook page, in remembering past legislative sessions, Jeff writes, I worked as a legislative page 3 years ago. I remember serving and drinking way too much coffee to the senators, running different bills all over the Capitol during the night, and then going to prom the next day.
People's lives do go on the outside world.
What will you be looking at, Kathy, James, or Joyce? Kathy, in the coming weeks, what's the big question for you that you would like answered?
Well, in the final legislative session also, I want to see how we resolve that question of nuclear power in Iowa. Right now, that bill is sort of dormant in the Senate. Whether Iowans will get the opportunity to help pay for a nuclear power plant before it goes online is a really contentious issue. And then looking ahead toward the congressional races, we've got some primaries in eastern Iowa, and we'll watch the presidential race starting to shape up.
Okay, Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, James Lynch of the Gazette, will enjoy looking forward to your writings as they come in the following weeks. Joyce Russell, of course, always looking forward to your hosting Politics on Mondays from the State House. Thank you all for your insights this hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon, technical support from Dennis Reese, and the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Our email is rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.